your name. Hey, hey. Well, she strolled on up to Mickey. Said, hey, big boy, what's your name?
Hello, this is Jill Maxwell, and you are listening to Peace Radio. That was Little Willie G. She's About a Mover. And Sally Prine is here. Jill Wagner is here. We're all reunited.
All here together again, yes.
No, 'cause I,
Sorry I was gone 2 weeks ago, but, you know, it was Spinal Tap.
Do you want to give us a rundown of the show today?
Well, you know, after 2 hours of wonderful Emily and beautiful songs and stuff, we've got to bring you down. We're going to talk about war, torture, and death. I mean,
yay.
You know, we're
our
the peace
topics.
Group, after all.
Yeah.
Start with news, headlines, weather. We do have some info from Code Pink and some action items, a little bit of info about a wonderful meeting that the Peace Coalition had yesterday, planning meeting, and planning in the works for something in the fall. And then second hour, we'll lighten up a little bit with some Howard Zinn audio and book reviews, movie reviews, and Miriam, who won't be here today, though, left us with some material for the end of the show.
Excellent.
So. Cool.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Headlines. In an interview with Gulf News, which is the Persian Gulf's largest daily English language newspaper, published from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates on May 12th, Pulitzer Prize-winning American investigative journalist Seymour Hersh said there is a special unit called the Joint Special Operations Command that does high-value targeting of men that are known to be involved in anti-American activities or are believed to be planning such activities. According to Hersh, the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, was headed by former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney and the former head of JSOC, Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal, who has just been named the new commander in charge of the war in Afghanistan. Oh. McChrystal, a West Pointer who became a Green Beret not long after graduation, following a stint as a platoon leader in the 82nd Airborne Division, is currently Director of Staff at the Pentagon, the executive to Joint Staff to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But that's a title.
Wow.
Yeah. This is from Al Jazeera.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Most of what General McChrystal has done over a 33-year career remains classified, including service between 2003 and 2008 as commander of the Joint Special Operations Command, an elite unit so clandestine that the Pentagon for years refused to acknowledge its existence. On July 22, 2006, Human Rights Watch issued a report titled, quote, No Blood, No Foul, about American torture practices at three facilities in Iraq. One of them was Camp Nama, which was operated by the JSOC under the direction of then-Major General Stanley McChrystal. Mm. McChrystal was officially based at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, but he was a frequent visitor to Camp Nama and other special forces bases in Iraq and Afghanistan, where forces under his command were based. An interrogator at Camp Nama described locking prisoners in shipping containers for 24 hours at a time in extreme heat, exposing them to extreme cold with periodic soaking in cold water, bombardment with bright lights and loud music, sleep deprivation, and severe beatings. When he and other interrogators went to the colonel in charge and expressed concern that this kind of treatment was not legal and that they might be investigated by the military's Criminal Investigation Division or the International Committee of the Red Cross, the colonel told them he had this directly from General McChrystal and the Pentagon that there's no way the Red Cross could get in. So that does not bode well for the war in Afghanistan.
No, I'd heard some things about him.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Barack Obama will revive the heavily criticized George Bush-era military tribunals for detainees at Guantanamo Bay, but will make them fairer, according to U.S. officials. Obama suspended the tribunals within hours of taking office in January, ordering a review of the military commission system, but he stopped short of abandoning the process altogether. The military trials will remain frozen for another 4 months as the administration adjusts the legal system. Expected to try fewer than 20 of the 241 detainees at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Officials say the amended system would limit the use of hearsay and ban evidence gained from cruel treatment, including the use of waterboarding. Defendants will be given the opportunity to pick their own lawyers and be provided with more protection if they do not testify. The decision to persist with the tribunals was immediately attacked by critics. Human rights campaigners point out that during last year's presidential campaign, Obama called the tribunal system, quote, an enormous failure, and that he vowed to, quote, reject the Military Commissions Act. But the president's aides say he never rejected the possibility of using military commissions altogether if they could be made fairer. They highlighted legislation he supported as a senator in 2006, intended to do just that. And they noted that some defendants would continue to be tried in American civilian courts, saying they were trying to create a, quote, durable, multi-layered option. 13 detainees, including 5 charged over the September 11th attacks, are already in the tribunal system, set up after the military began sweeping the battlefields of Afghanistan in late 2001. 3 Guantanamo detainees have been convicted in the tribunals so far, and the restrictions on evidence will almost certainly mean only a fraction of those held will go to trial. The rest of the detainees would either be released, transferred to other countries, or tried in civilian courts, officials said. The decision to restart the process puts the administration in a race against the clock to conclude commission trials before the Navy prison is closed by January 2010. And in our last headline for this hour, in news from the Mideast, rival Palestinian factions Hamas and Fatah have begun a 5th round of talks aimed at forming a deal to share power, the latest session in months of fruitless negotiations. Egyptian intelligence chief General Omar Suleiman, the top mediator in the talks, met with 2 delegations last week and gave them a deadline of July 5th to reach an agreement. Ezzat Rishk, a Hamas official who participated in the meeting, said, Egypt has proposed Hamas would stay out of the transitional government, allowing President Mahmoud Abbas to run it, an Egyptian official involved in the discussion said. In return, Hamas and other Palestinian factions would become part of an advisory committee that would be given a say in the government's decisions, he said, speaking on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to talk to the media. Hamas Gaza strongman Mahmoud Zahar, at the start of Saturday's session, said the group was still studying the Egyptian proposal. He repeated the group's position that it will not be part of any government program that involves the recognition of the Jewish state. The key stumbling block in the Egyptian-mediated talks remains the political program of a unity government that would be in power until elections are held in January 2010. The international community says it will only deal with the Palestinian government that recognizes Israel, a concession Hamas is unwilling to make. Meanwhile, Egypt on Saturday opened its borders with the Gaza Strip to allow the departure of a number of Palestinians traveling to Egypt for medical treatment. Among other travelers, Hamas authorities said. A statement by Hamas Interior Ministry said the crossing will remain open for 2 days, adding that only patients, students, and holders of foreign passports and residence permits are allowed to leave. So those are our headlines for this hour, and now we will hear a song, Alpha Blondy, Dictator.
Dans l'unité, le totalitarisme xénophobe mènera à l'adversité. Avec son corollaire de colère généralisée, toutes les atrocités dans la cité. Sans péril, en triomphe, sans gloire. Vos lois fébriles nous poussent au désespoir. Je refuse l'exil, car Dieu est ma gloire. Je refuse l'exil, car Dieu est ma victoire. La carotte et le bâton, attention au retour de bâton.
Aïe, ça peut faire mal.
La paix sociale, la paix civile ne peut se réaliser que dans l'unité, dans l'unité, dans l'unité.
Thermomètre qu'on fera baisser la fièvre.
That was Alpha Blondie, Dictator. Sally?
Okay. Yeah, I thought I'd read the latest Code Pink action alert. I get these in on my email, and these women have just been consistently a voice for peace, mm-hmm. And a voice for action, too. So they write, as of Friday, about the House voting 368-60 to spend billions of dollars. And I just now realized how lopsided that number is. 368 people voted in the House to spend billions of our tax dollars, almost $100 billion, $96.7 billion, for continued funding for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Hmm. 60 voted against. While we walk the halls of Congress, the Code Pink women write, all week urging a no vote, Congress members were being lobbied hard by the White House to vote for it. President Barack Obama met with a progressive caucus to push the war funding, and each member who showed skepticism received phone calls from the White House. 51 courageous Democrats did vote against this. Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey said that the bill has no exit strategy, and it allocates over 90% of the money for the military and less than 10% for development. This even contradicts General Petraeus' own counterinsurgency doctrine of 80% non-military and 20% military. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. So next week, the war funding will be voted for in the Senate. So here is the phone number. Sit down, get a pencil and a piece of paper, take down this phone number. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. 202-224-3121. Ask for your senator and say loudly and clearly that you want him or her to vote him in Idaho. This is Idaho. That you want him to vote against more money for war. And that number again is 202-224-3121. I will do so. Jill will do so. Jill will do so.
That was two Jills.
That's three.
I might call twice.
Jake will do so.
Who is our senators? Who are our senators? Good Lord. Who is them?
Larry Craig. No.
Long.
No.
Minnick.
Minnick.
And he's our North Idaho one, I think. And,
yes.
And,
yes.
Crapo.
Crapo.
South Idaho.
Which is spelled?
C-R-A-P-O.
Crapo.
But we call it Crapo.
It's pronounced Crapo.
Crapo. But it's an easy one to remember. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that number again, 202-224-3121. And here are some...
Say no to war funding.
Say no to war funding. And here are some, if I can find my piece of paper, key talking points. Number one, at a time of economic crisis and multiplying domestic needs, not to mention global climate change, which is just galloping toward us.
Yes.
The 2009 supplemental is an appalling waste of our money. Number two, the supplemental funds the increase of troops to Afghanistan, escalating the war rather than ending it. Three, the supplemental places no restrictions on American bombings in either Afghanistan or Pakistan, despite the disproportionate harm to civilian inhabitants. This is beyond horrible. And number four... Yeah. Supplemental maintains a high level of American troops in Iraq for the duration of 2009. So only 60 nay votes in the House, and of course none from Idaho or Washington, it looks like, here as I'm looking at the list.
Wow.
So, once again, next week is the war funding bill coming up in the Senate, and it passed so overwhelmingly. I think that's the thing that's so troubling.
Right.
Is how lopsided that vote was in the time of economic crisis. I mean, we are so concerned about the economy, and yet we're so stubborn with this. And what was it that we talked about a couple of weeks ago about how our defense budget is twice the rest of the countries combined?
Right.
I'm
not sure of the exact figure, but you could reduce the total defense budget by 40% and still be back where we were at the end of the Clinton era.
It just escalated.
Despite their reputation of Republicans for being fiscally conservative, or at least their PR announcing it constantly, more than doubling the defense budget. And does that even include the mercenaries that we hire?
No, I don't think so.
That's just the outright defense budget. So it's actually much larger than that.
Yeah. And it probably also doesn't include the after war, the costs of the Veterans Administration costs and things like that.
Right.
That's where the cost of these police actions, as they call them, really doubles because of
it's
the cost of taking care of people afterwards. Yeah. Well, let's move on to torture, because this is part
of... better and better.
This is an article by Joe Connison that I just ran into this morning, and he's a wonderful, consistent writer. I think many of us know who've been following this torture it's been out since, 2000... What was the Downing Street memo? Was 2004 or something? Mm-hmm. So it's not new. It's been 5 years, but the one thing that's maybe come out recently is how much these torture techniques were used to justify the war itself.
Right.
To justify it wasn't, according to Connison here, it wasn't used exclusively to prevent imminent acts of terror or collect actionable intelligence, but to invent evidence that would link al-Qaeda with Saddam Hussein and connect the late dictator to the 9/11 attacks. So, it makes your head explode. I mean, just more and more, the more information comes out. And I did see a few pictures this morning on the web that were just appalling, just horrible.
Are these the pictures that Obama deemed should not be released.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how we figured they would not get out.
They're out already.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, openness seems to be the best. But anyway, Connison goes on to write, in one report after another from journalists, former administration officials, and Senate investigators, the same theme continues to emerge. Whenever a prisoner believed to possess any knowledge of al-Qaeda's operations or Iraqi intelligence came into American custody, CIA interrogators felt intense pressure from the Bush White House to produce evidence of an al-Qaeda-Iraq relationship, which contradicted everything the U.S. intelligence and other experts knew about the enmity between Saddam and Osama bin Laden. Indeed, the futile quest for proof of that connection is a common thread running through the gruesome stories of torture from the Guantanamo detainee camp to Egyptian prisons to the CIA's black sites in Thailand and elsewhere. So not only is it happening, it's happening to further a lie. It's happening to cause more misery, more deaths, more to start a war, in other words. In an essay that first appeared on the Washington Note blog, Wilkinson, who is... let's see if I can get a first name here. Anyway, says that even when the interrogators of Alibi, the Libyan al-Qaeda operative, reported that he had become compliant, the vice president's office ordered further torture of him by his hosts at an Egyptian prison because he had not yet implicated Saddam with al-Qaeda. And he's the guy that just recently, conveniently committed suicide. His name is Alibi, in a prison cell in Libya. So we won't be able to discuss what actually happened to him and why. And here's another investigative report in the Daily Beast, authored by former NBC News producer Robert Windrum, who interviewed two former senior intelligence officers who told him a similar story about a different prisoner. In April 2003, U.S. forces captured an Iraqi official named Mohammed Khudayr al-Duyami, who had served in Saddam's secret police. Those unnamed officials said that upon learning of his capture, the vice president's office proposed that CIA agents in Baghdad commence waterboarding him in order to elicit information about a link between al-Qaeda and Saddam. Evidently, that suggestion was not enforced at this particular time, but but there's the same kind of demands were directed toward interrogators in Guantanamo, according to the testimony of former Army psychiatrist Charles Burney, who testified that he and his colleagues interrogating prisoners at the detention camp felt pressure to produce proof of the mythical link. So if this, you know, if these guys go free, I mean, they're out on Fox News and various news.
Chains all over,
Yeah,
I mean, he won't shut up now.
Really?
Yeah.
With this background information, I don't know,
and they kept saying before that they can't discuss it because it would hurt national security, and now Cheney will not shut up. He does nothing but discuss it, but then when he's asked questions, he claims executive privilege, and I don't know. And I don't know what to make of not releasing the latest set of pictures either that, you know, Obama said he would release, and then suddenly he says he won't release.
There's some. There's got to be some weird pressure on him, you know.
Yes,
and
it's got to be insane.
I think one of the things that the progressive movement needs to keep in mind is that, you know, Obama's definitely getting tons of pressure from certain corporate and you know, and military sides. It's really up to us on the peace side and the progressive side to be visible. So
and keep our pressure on there. So call your senators.
Your reps. Phone calls at the very least.
Call them every day.
Right.
Emails. They do count those, even if you don't get to talk to anybody real. They count them.
They count them, and they do a yes no. And in fact, and I think I mentioned this on the air, you know, a while ago, but I do periodically read the Idaho paper, and I remember reading, I forget which one of our legislators saying he hadn't heard. You know, there was some issue, and he hadn't heard from Idahoans. They don't, you know, they want to hear from people within their voting districts,
right?
And they, you know, you give them your zip code and your Mm-hmm. Yes or no. And I mean, it doesn't have to be a long conversation. They don't necessarily want that, but they do want a yes or no. So.
Yep. And they've all got a website, and there's a drop-down list of current topics.
That phone number.
We're good after last week.
calling your senators. 202-224-3121. Call make your voices heard. So, did want to mention briefly that there was a 4-hour Peace Coalition meeting that sounded dreadful in advance, because meetings anyway are sort of, you know, but this was a very productive, there were about 10, 11 of us or so, and just talking about what's next for the Peace Coalition besides standing on the street corner with signs and doing an occasional event. We are going to do something in the fall. Not sure what yet, but if you're interested, you can email me. My name's Sally Perrine, and my email is sperrine, P-E-R-R-I-N-E, at potlatch.com. If you're interested in helping to plan an event for the fall, it takes about 4 months to put something together, so we need to start now. We are also meeting on Friday at 6:30 after the vigil at Sisters Coffee House. So if anybody's interested in joining in, and, you know, thinking in terms of maybe bringing a speaker in, but also some kind of events around that. And so, 6:30 this Friday, the whatever the date is, 20-something.
22nd.
Second, I believe. Yeah,
22nd. It's the 22nd.
This Friday at 6:30 at Sisters Brew. So
right downstairs from radio station. So.
Yeah. Or right down the street, at least. And downstairs, yes.
It's kitty corner.
Thank you.
So did you want to talk at all about
the evils of anthropology?
Sure.
Yeah, because I am one, and
You're one of the evils of anthropology?
I am. I'm ambivalent about being an anthropologist. And especially now that I work for an Indian tribe, I usually start with, I'm so sorry, I'm an anthropologist. You have people calling up and go, Indians are neat. Like, yeah, Indians are people. Anywho, the story that Sally just handed me from Darja Mail from 16 May 2009, titled Engineering Trust of the Indigenous Population, that was in quote marks, : How Some Anthropologists Have Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Army. And I love that there's a colon, because there's never been an anthropology paper without a colon in the title. and it's true, and it talks about the current HTS, Human Terrain System, which I had heard about before, a Pentagon program that uses anthropologists, sociologists, psychologists, but mostly anthropologists, embedded with the military in Afghanistan and Iraq. And supposedly it's to help the military make better decisions, and it's marketed as saving people. And I'm sorry, we've heard this before. Mm-hmm.
But it is military impact.
It is very military, and anthropology has almost always been very linked to the military. It's a colonial endeavor, and now we call it post-colonial, but the people we're still occupying would definitely argue the post. They are still being colonized.
It's a different empire now.
Yeah.
That's all.
But we're still colonizing. We're trying to get Afghanistan and Iraq. We need their stuff. Sorry. Try not to swear.
And succeeding.
Yay, so far. I can't afford the fine. So anyway, this started way back with people. The inquiry of anthropology started because colonists like Portugal, Spain, and England needed to understand the people they were colonizing in order to do it better. Mm-hmm. And getting important decrees like Indians don't have a soul, therefore they don't have to live. But then the Pope reversed that in the 1800s. They got a soul. So that was really cool. Like it was up to the Pope. And then talking in World War II, I think it was, when Ruth Benedict, fairly famous anthropologist, possibly a girlfriend of Margaret Mead, wrote The Sword and the Chrysanthemum, and it's seen as one of the seminal works on Japanese culture, and it was essentially produced in order to study Japanese culture so we'd know how to deal with them in the war.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And, translation often goes to anthropologists. And when I graduated with my bachelor's, I got one in linguistics and one in anthropology. Before I made it out of the building on the last day of class, the CIA stopped me, and they were stopping all the linguists.
Wow.
To see if we wanted to sign up. And they said, for only, we'll give you 5 free years of education and all this money to study any language, but you had to agree to inform on the people you were working with. Mm-hmm. And then they went and interviewed the anthropologist, too. I'm like, answer's still no. I'm not going to do that. But, you know, in the 80s, it was a Reagan era. There was no money for grad school. Mm-hmm, I just paid my loans off recently. And, you know, it was tempting to a lot of people. I know one or two who did it. Mm-hmm. They said, well, I just listen. It's like you listen and then you rat people out. And the whole, you know, the ethics of anthropology always say you don't turn in the people. You don't do anything that can harm the people you're working with. Right. But even though just being there, we spread disease.